More under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. We did it.
We can say our names. We're so
excited. We don't have to stay here for another 2 hours.
Ooh, we said our names.
We said our names together in harmony and in...
I don't know about harmony. We did say our names, though.
They weren't discordant. It wasn't discordant.
That's true. That is true.
So that was harmonious because it wasn't discordant. See?
Well, I'm not sure that there's probably a middle ground in there somewhere that we fall very nicely.
Yeah, we do. We fall very nicely.
We fall quite often.
We fall very awkwardly, but... And this is the Personal Wealth Coach, as we just said, in case you weren't listening. And the Personal Wealth Coach is also the name of a registered investment advisory firm in Salado, Texas, that is registered with the United States Securities and Exchange Commission with neither approve or disapprove. And the secretary will deny all knowledge of the event if we're captured.
This radio program will self-destruct and... No, we won't. And hopefully not. We self-destruct talking.
There'll be a recording of it, but it'll self-destruct in a little under 2 hours. So you either catch it now or it's no longer live. It's dead. And once it's dead, it's by definition self-destructed. Although you can get it on podcasts from thepersonalwealthcoach.com. Anyway, back to the subject at hand. What we offer on here, despite the fact that the two guys, Jeff and Jake, are the principals of a registered investment advisory firm, is that we are not giving investment advice. We're giving educational information, which is a different animal altogether. And we can go into the phylum and the philia and the so on if you want.
It's a very strange animal.
And the information we present on this radio program, it's not a show because you can't see us. Nah, 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 nah.
It's more of a tell.
It's a tell. Well, it's not a tell because actually a tell is something you see in a game, in a poker game. So it's not really a tell.
That's what you're telling.
Oh, anyway, it's a say.
Anyway. So thank you for listening to our radio say.
Well, I promised in the newsletter this week that we'd mumble.
We are definitely mumbling.
Anyway, the information we present has been obtained from sources we deem, believe, and otherwise think are reliable, things like the Wall Street Journal, which we find to be generally quite reliable.
The Bureau of Labor Statistics.
Yes.
They're pretty reliable, unless they're closed.
And the Bureau of Economic Analysis.
Yep.
And Financial Times and Barron's and a few places like that.
Forbes and...
Well, I don't know if I get very much
from The Economist.
From
well, as long as you stay...
Oh, The Economist. Really, I do get it from The Economist.
Really far away from the opinion stuff, Forbes is pretty good.
We try to stay away from publications where the opinion migrates over to the front page and appears as a news story.
Yeah.
But other than that, it's pretty straight stuff, and we double-check it with something else.
That says something. We don't generally use CNN as a news source. CNN has been working really hard to be the news, and by that I don't mean report the news, I mean be the news. We don't appreciate that very much.
Yep. Anyway, that's all true stuff. Let's see, is there anything else we need to do? Close cover before striking, that doesn't make any sense anymore.
Oh, yeah. People... Though our firm is registered with the SEC, that does not mean...
I already said that.
They're confirmed deny. Oh, yeah. That
yeah.
Part, so
yeah, the secretary will neither confirm nor deny your existence.
Right. And the commission will definitely...
well, they'll confirm we exist.
They'll confirm we exist and definitely deny that they had any approval of us.
Right.
That's the case, for sure.
They neither approve nor disapprove.
Correct.
Until they investigate.
Or examine.
Oh, that's right. They examine.
Yeah.
They don't audit. They examine.
Yes. It's not an audit. It's an examination, and it's not an investigation. It's an examination.
Somebody got tired of hearing us ramble on and wanted to call and stick some sense into this. So whoever is calling on 254-773-1400, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Good morning, guys. Enjoy the show.
Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you doing?
I'm doing well.
You like your new life?
I haven't slowed down enough to enjoy it.
Okay. Well, you need to report back on the changes that have gone on at some point.
I will do that.
All right.
There was a story, I don't know, 2 weeks ago about the sale of F-35 Raptors to Turkey.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, they were buying Russian surface-to-air missiles. So
yep.
The two questions I have, what impact does U.S. military sales have to the economy.
Well, I think the impact is not on the economy. It's generally on other military supplies.
Okay.
Yeah. It's a direct impact, literally.
He's making a joke there.
Go ahead.
Oh, good. He laughed.
Thank you. That was very nice laughter.
Very diplomatic laugh.
What's the percentage impact of the overall economy? And I don't know if you know this, but the variance that the U.S. sells to foreign governments, is it the exact same device, or do they hold back some of the features or technologies?
Okay, good question. Good question.
Hang up and listen.
All right. Well, let me answer your last question first while Jake is investigating the economic impact. The basic F-35 airframe, obviously, is something we're selling to Turkey, who's not the most reliable ally we've ever had.
Let me give a quick reference here before you move further, because in the middle of this, the same week, India and Pakistan have had little fisticuffs going on.
Minor ones, yes.
Minor ones. So Pakistan knocked down an Indian MiG, Russian MiG, with an American surface-to-air or air-to-air missile, AMRAAM, air-to-air, while India used F-16s, American F-16s, to bomb non-military targets in Pakistan. So both of them violated their end-user agreement with the United States.
You need to notice the difference between the definition of what they bombed between India and Pakistan. India claims it was just a wooded mountaintop, and there was nobody on it.
There's a really good reason to bomb wooded mountaintops, if you ask me. Nobody will ever get hurt. Nobody can complain about it.
That's right. You can't complain about killing civilians.
Think of how many wars you can win by bombing mountains.
There it is. And of course, the Indians said, no, that was a terrorist training camp.
Right.
So that's how much you can trust all of that. Now, the F-35 is a very sophisticated, stealthy, high-powered jet, which we sell to people like Turkey, who's a member of NATO. And that, by the way, helps finance the purchase in the United States because it lowers the cost per aircraft. They have some pretty stiff restrictions on what they can do and how they have to shelter it and so on. But by and large, and I can tell you this was going on when I was in the Army, when we sell a piece of equipment like that, everything that's on that piece of equipment is something our potential enemies already know in detail. We don't give them the ultra top secret electronics, for example, that and systems on there that are the cutting edge of what we can and cannot do. So there's a lot goes into that. And yeah, there is. So in essence, the F-35s that Turkey is getting are significantly degraded from the ones we have. They still are going to be better than anything anybody else has in the neighborhood.
Right. As a percentage of our economy, military exports aren't that large, but we are the number one military exporter in the world. We sell very large amounts of military gear all over the place, and it runs in the tens and some years hundreds of billions of dollars. So if you think of that as a percentage of a $14 trillion economy, it's not very much. But if you're one of the companies that's doing it, it's your bread and butter.
Well, since our trade deficit last year, we can segue into that one real quickly, jumped to a record $814 billion.
Yeah.
A few hundred billion of military sales.
That makes a difference.
Narrow that down quite a lot.
We would be at the trillion mark or very close to it. We don't have the numbers for 2018 completed yet for exports, and they're never extremely accurate. There are State Department and secrecy issues involved in our military exports. You can't really tell what the end user agreement is. And that, for those of you who have not read Tom Clancy, I recommend pulling out Tom Clancy because he talks in detail about this. And if you would like to learn it in a fictional and novel way, while you're still actually learning facts, that's a good way to do it. Or Conversely, you could read the regulations at the State Department. That's a much drier way of learning it.
It's an easy way to go to sleep. If you have insomnia, yeah. Reading federal regulations will definitely cure your insomnia in record time.
Each export, it doesn't matter to whom the export is going. Each export has a separate end-user agreement. It's very much like the thing that you click without reading when you're downloading the newest
the
phone application updates. Only in this case, if they don't read it, there are some really severe repercussions that could happen.
Which we generally don't exercise.
Right. We have not exercised any of those repercussions in a very long time, but it's... part of our invasion of Panama, part of our invasion of Guatemala and Nicaragua were due to end-user license problems. So just think if Apple decided to sue everyone who hadn't read their end-user license agreement, nobody would buy Apple products anymore. And that's the same kind of sentiment to if the United States decided to invade everyone that misused its exports.
Another aspect of things like the F-35 getting exported, the Russians, I think, very comfortably are going to see this thing and photograph it and put microscopes on it and everything else once it gets to Turkey. The issue is the materials that are part of the F-35 probably, based on my experience and research, the Russians simply don't have the ability to make that stuff. And you know, they'd have to have whole new factories and technologies come into existence. It's not like a piece of electronics that you can reverse engineer. There's just a lot of things that we can afford to export them because the technology that goes into creating the skin, for example, of the F-35 is pretty much limited to the manufacturer. The technology would have to be known and understood, and you'd have to build an entire factory just to build this new piece of equipment. So it's a trade-off. If we sell a lot of F-35s to NATO members, which we'd like to do, then NATO will be better prepared to fight a Russian invasion. And fundamentally, the Turks hate the Russians. I don't care what you hear from elsewhere. They hate them with a passion.
Extreme passion. And right now they're making deals with them, but there's a fierce underlying competition between them. They're too close together. And the Turks see the repercussions of all of the little wars that are still going on right next to them.
Yeah, and they actually... One of the things that's not well published is the Turks still officially lay claim to Armenia as part of Turkey, and the Russians are saying, no, it's not. And there's some other chunks of what the
Azerbaijan has got big Turkish influence, and there's a massive war that both sides are being funded by the Russians.
And so the one thing I can tell you about when we sell something like the F-35 to Turkey that looks like it's sort of a stupid thing to do, there's an awful lot of complexity goes into that. And one of the things that was key when I worked in the intelligence business was the fact that in order to maintain that F-35, you have to have a bunch of American technicians in country supporting this thing, which means there's a limit to how hostile Turkey can get or the F-35s won't work anymore.
Just ask India about that, because their American-built and Russian-built airplanes are falling apart because they have not been paying Americans and Russians to come and fix them. Mm-hmm.
And so our foreign policy and our trade agreements, particularly in the defense area, are immensely complex. And I think, generally speaking, very, very well thought out. We haven't seen American-made equipment attacking Americans. We saw a little of that in Afghanistan because that was a very poorly thought out decision to give the best some of the Stingers, for example, to jihadists in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
But they basically, when they tried to fire them, most of them fizzled because they hadn't been properly maintained.
This is another one. This is one of those things that will be a good mnemonic. People will remember the event. Benghazi. Many of the, well, several of the people that died in the Benghazi attack, the riot and terrorist activities, were contractors that were pulled off of their normal duty, which was going out there and buying Stinger missiles from the population who had just raided Gaddafi's stockpiles. So we've been selling missiles to Gaddafi. As of, between 2013 and 2017, the United States sold weapons to at least 98 countries.
Now, was it Stingers or Red Eyes?
It was Stingers.
The Stingers, okay.
And they were paying $100 bills for those Stingers, and they were taking the Stinger and putting them behind their truck tire and rolling over them backwards and then sticking the parts up in the back of the truck and driving away. And
we were.
The contractors were there for. And the reason why more Americans were not killed is because those contractors were in the vicinity and they were called in for the safe house and then the defense, yeah.
Of the consulate, yeah.
Right, and some of them lost their lives in the process. Which, by the way, that's an interesting piece. We've got American contractors out there that in cases like this get called into official kind of almost military roles, but then when they die, they are not given any of those honors because that's not why they're there. They have to go through the State Department to be out there, and this community here in Central Texas, it's very likely that people listening to this radio program have either been military contractors or know people that are, and are recognizing that the high paycheck that they receive for being somewhere for an extended period of time doesn't necessarily pay for the long-term medical and other repercussions of things that happen there.
Of course, most of them are retired military.
Yeah, most of them are retired military, but not all of them.
Yeah,
many of the construction workers that go over to places like Saudi Arabia and Dubai and Ethiopia.
So let's segue to the markets.
Yes, let's do that. We're already near halfway into the program and haven't even talked about the markets yet.
I want to quote from our newsletter that we published yesterday afternoon. The impressive recovery from last year's market swoon that ended on December 31st, that was the bottom, finally ran out of gas this week ending March 8th, or 9th, I guess it technically ends. Well, the market week ended on the 8th. We had five consecutive days of down market. Now, that sounds pretty bad. It was down 2.16%. Why? Well, it was a steady drip, 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 drip of bad economic news. And on Friday, we'll talk about this some more. We got a real stunner when instead, in January, we created in the United States economy the first estimate and, well, the adjusted estimate now, 311,000 new jobs and filled them. Actually, the jobs were there, but we filled 311,000 new jobs. We hired 311,000 people more than were laid off or fired. And then come February, we hired 20,000, which is, the bottom dropped out of the hiring market in February, according to this release.
Well, the bottom didn't drop out. I mean, we're still hired more than we fired, but 20,000 is not very much for an economy our size.
And so you would think when that was released on Friday, the bottom would drop out of the market. It didn't. It just continued sagging downward. That was just one more drip because nobody knows whether it's real or not real. The government shutdown is still having an effect, by the way. That's why the unemployment rate dropped from 4 to 3.8. Probably the most probable reason we saw an improvement in unemployment is the government workers went back to work in February. And so what we have is a market that is dipped now. It's down, for those of you who keep record, it's down 2.16 for the week, 1.56 below where it was a year ago, and 6.4% below where it was last September. This is not particularly good news, but it does mean that the price-to-earnings ratio, because earnings have continued to rise, keeps getting better and better and better in this market. And we got, you know, there were housing starts bumped a little bit, but they're still down. Existing house sales are down. So what we did is we saw the market losing its recovery momentum. Now, it didn't recover all the way to where we saw it at the beginning of the fourth quarter last year, but it did a pretty good recovery. We had double-digit returns until the end of this week. Now we're at about 9-point-something. 10-year U.S. Treasury note declined just a tiny little bit. We've still got a we still are way below the peak interest rate we saw again last year. And the higher the interest rate on the 10-year note, by the way, the more optimistic the bond market is about future economic growth. And when it drops, as it has been doing for a year now, except for that one spike it did late last year, it indicates that they think, well, sometime in the future we're not going to do as well. And very specifically, there's a sag in the bond yield curve between 2 and 5 years, which means they're thinking a couple of years from now or a year from now, we could have a recession or we could have a real serious economic slowdown. And that's something worth paying attention to. And that's kind of what's going on in the market. Gold is still down from last year at this time. Normally, when there's bad economic news, gold jumps. It doesn't anymore, in case you haven't noticed. When there's bad economic news, gold tends to sag a little bit because gold no longer fulfills the role it once did. So that's what we've seen in the markets. If you've got a good, well-balanced portfolio, you're still probably doing pretty good on a 3-year trailing average. And as we've said before, it's a good idea to keep some dry powder because at some point all this bad news may come around and manifest. Now,
yeah,
but
so what's happened this week? And you know, you reported some things in the newsletter about unemployment. We talked about that, but how about productivity?
Yeah.
This is something we didn't touch in the newsletter, but
didn't have enough room for more words.
What we've had is a kind of avalanche of data from the government shutdown. So productivity numbers are being reported for the fourth quarter of 2018.
Yeah, like for last year.
So most people, if you heard about it, it was just a blip, a real quick statement somewhere. Someone said, productivity was up 1.9% for the last quarter of 2018, and then they didn't say anything more about it because it's almost done with the first quarter when we get this information for the last quarter of last year.
That's what a government shutdown will do for you.
Yeah. What it means is that, as we suspected when we were talking about what was going on, there was some consolidation to the hiring that took place throughout the year in 2018. We had some drops in productivity because of hiring. And people, just to kind of fill in the blanks there, if you're running a business and you're doing really well and all your employees are working extra hard, they're probably at the highest productivity level they've ever been in their lives. And you say, we're running out of steam. We can't keep this up. We got to hire somebody. Well, unfortunately, as soon as you hire someone, your productivity is going to drop. You've got an extra expense and your productivity goes down because you've got to take people off of the line or off of whatever it is that they're doing that's been so productive to teach somebody else who's pretty unproductive. They really don't know what they're doing. So they have to be ushered along. And anybody who has ever taught anyone anything knows that it's going to take a while and it's going to take time out of your schedule to teach them. It's worth doing. It's a long-term investment. What we were seeing in the last quarter of last year was the beginnings of that investment reaping some returns. The problem with it is that we also, right about the same time, smacked face first into the wall of capacity utilization. We just don't have enough truck drivers. We don't have enough people to hire. So part of that productivity gain was hard to find people to hire. So you got to figure out how to make the people you have do better at what they're doing.
And that's, by the way, one of the reasons that employers are reporting anecdotally for the low hiring numbers is they just can't find anybody to hire.
Right.
Which historically, by the way, has marked the peak of an economic growth cycle.
What we're looking at now from anyone's opinion, there might be just a few economists that would disagree with this, but the vast majority would agree. We're at full employment. We have pulled people out of places where they were no longer looking for work and yanked them back into the job market. We've reached the bottom of the bucket. If we want to hire more people, you're going to have to take it from somebody else's business. You're going to have to hire someone that already has a job. And there are some unemployed. We see that. There are people that are underemployed and unemployed. But they live in places that they're not willing to leave in many cases.
Yeah, that's one of the big issues.
So
the other thing, the other headline in economics this week was the trade deficit officially was reported for 2018, and it was an all-time record. And it would have been a lot worse had it not. Now, this is an interesting thing. We have a surplus in services. In other words, the services we provide in export, where we do something in a back office sort of way or an executive sort of way for manufacturing that's done overseas, we actually have a trade surplus in that area. But so our... We had a 600 and something thousand, this I don't remember, $621 billion trade deficit last year. But we had an $814 billion manufacturing trade deficit. So if you're worried about manufacturing leaving the country and moving overseas, yeah, it's happening, but that's not the big deal. The big deal is we have a record-breaking quantity of manufacturing that's going on in the United States. We just can't keep up with the demand. There's a couple of reasons we can't keep up with the demand. One, there's just not enough people to hire. We're not allowing people into the country to work, so we have to import stuff from overseas that's been made overseas. And secondly, you may have noticed, but at the beginning of last year, we got a massive fiscal stimulus called the new tax law.
And another fiscal stimulus from the spending associated with the spending bills.
So we got a 9% increase in federal spending last year, and a 1.5 for the calendar year. We got a 1.5% decrease in federal revenue. And when you add all that together, that explains why for the first 4 months of the fiscal year, and the fiscal year for the federal government begins in October, so October, November, December, January, the federal deficit was 77% higher than it was in the previous year. As a matter of fact, it's now creeping up to the point where if this continues, if we continue on the same track we're on, we'll pretty soon break all records for deficits, for deficit spending. And in the near future, we're definitely running the total amount we owe on Treasury bills and Treasury securities up to records. It is on a record level, and those two things go together. We have this big stimulus in the economy that's causing consumers to spend more money. We have a big stimulus in the economy that's causing businesses to spend more money. We don't have the capacity of meeting that demand, so we have to import a lot of stuff. That's a economics term, technical term.
Yeah,
and
technical.
Speaking of technical terms, we probably have some technical...
Commercials.
Commercials.
We do. We'll play some commercials. We'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you would like to join us, the phone number in here is 254-773-1400, and if you have no sports questions, we may actually be able to talk about it. So we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake.
McClure.
Well, what happened there?
I got tangled up in my tongue.
You were swallowing your tongue right in the middle of the...
Yeah, tongue swallowing.
That's why we're so excited when we can actually say our names.
Yeah, well, you know, we got to practice a few more decades and maybe we'll get it right.
Maybe.
Anyway, this is the Personal Wealth Coach, and the telephone number in here is 254-773-1400. Presuming that today is the 9th of March where you are. Now, I find it astonishing that it's March 9th. We're about to lose an hour to posterity, or posterity, or something like that. And that's a little scary, actually. Where does that hour go?
Quantumly?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the point is, there's an hour that's going to disappear tonight.
No, it doesn't disappear. That's the whole thing is that it exists. It just goes by in less than a second. Just gone.
Pew. Well, time moves more slowly as you move faster, but it doesn't move faster. I mean, we can't get a lot slower than we are.
I don't know. I'm feeling kind of lazy today.
So time goes by really, really quickly. I don't know. That hour, that hour back in the fall. And so where is it stored all summer?
This is a very simple answer. It's a quantum storage unit devised by Act of Congress when the daylight savings.
Is that like Activision?
Yes. And there's an Act of Congress that there is a Al Gore's lockbox was never used for Social Security. So they repurposed it and used it for the extra hour that disappears because they have to take it out of that reserve in the fall.
Well, now that you.
And let them use it again.
You had a very quotable quote this morning.
Oh, really? What was it?
It was, we're going to gain daylight. We're going to save daylight by giving up an hour of sleep.
Right. Which makes no real sense to me. I'd rather not give up the hour of sleep or get an extra. Let's just go and say the time doesn't change all over the place throughout the year.
I think it probably has something to do with dark matter because we're going to lose some darkness.
Dark matter is what is between the ears of congressional representatives. That is your physics test question of the day, is that when you're talking about the relativity issues of time dilation, and we have multiple periods of time dilation in our year, devised by Act of Congress, we have to say that the variable involved is the dark matter between the ears of the congressional representative.
We're going to leap forward 1 hour through time.
Yes.
And then we'll get retarded in the fall.
Yes. And all of that massive power expenditure, because if you think in terms of relativity, the speed you have to go to get that kind of time dilation is huge amounts of energy. It's all in paper written by Congress.
I'm going to have to think about that for a while. That makes sense.
Fascinating.
Anyway. This is the Personal Wealth Coach. The telephone number in here still remains 254-773-1400. A lot of things went on during the week. And, you know, we talked about the fact that there's this massive.
That was a good accent, whatever that was.
I don't know. Massive trade deficit that we are experiencing. And there was a very good article in Barron's Up and Down Wall Street. He says, don't sweat it. I agree, by the way. We really don't have a trade deficit. We never have had a trade deficit.
Right, we don't have a trade deficit.
Now, we had one in the 19th century several times. But
Forbes wrote a story on this. This is really? One of the things. Yeah, they said, it sounded like they were just quoting things that have come out of our office.
They probably listened to the podcast
right,
or something.
Yeah, saying that we manufacture this paper product that we sell throughout the world as a barter for very nice equipment and televisions and things. And that paper product is called the dollar.
Mm-hmm. And actually, most of it isn't even paper. It's just
electronics.
Now, although, as you mentioned, in Libya, we were trading a piece of paper for a Stinger missile.
Yeah.
And we have the ability to manufacture as many of those pieces of paper as we want. And one piece of paper is good for one Stinger missile, which is actually a real bargain.
That's a really good
those
trade.
Cost. Of course, the fact is, if I recall my articles and knowledge correctly on this, those Stinger missiles probably wouldn't have fired anyway.
Probably not. But you don't want to have that as a question on our airports as we're taking off and landing.
I mean, if Stinger missiles unmaintained for many years would fire, a lot of airlines would have been shot down by now. But in fact, they don't. After you, the head in those things has to be maintained. It's a super cooled head, and the nitrogen and everything has to be just right.
So just think about your newest, up-to-date, purchased computer. Turn it off for 3 years and see how well it works when you turn it back on.
Yeah.
And that's not as sensitive to things as as the Stinger missile.
Yeah, it's kind of like all the other high tech stuff we have. It doesn't have a long shelf life without good maintenance. It's also true of nuclear weapons. Thank God.
Thank goodness. Yes, that's definitely true.
But there's a reason we have a big trade deficit. We have a big trade deficit because
our economy is doing well.
We have a strong economy. And here's an ironic point, if I could. Can I?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, I'm going to wax eloquent here for just a second. One of the major reasons we have a big trade deficit is because we have tariffs. Tariffs that were imposed by the president, by executive order, to lower the trade deficit. In fact, they increased the trade deficit. Let me explain why. Actually, he put on the steel trade deficit, for example, to employ more steel workers in the United States. But when he did so, it bumped the price of steel in the United States up by 40%, simply because there's a shortage of cheap steel in the United States now. So that meant the steel foundries that were shutting down very profitable because the price is up 40%, and they're very, very happy. Here's the problem, and Caterpillar, this is not my speculation. The Caterpillar CEO warned about this twice now in his earnings calls. He said that the problem is that in order to make that heavy equipment that Caterpillar makes and exports, they're the number one heavy equipment manufacturer in the world, in order to make that stuff and export it, you have to use steel. And since steel in the United States is 40% more expensive than it is virtually anywhere else in the world because of the tariffs, that means that Caterpillar is going to not do well in the future, and he pointed that out. We're not expecting to do well in the future because our equipment is just too expensive, and that's a fact. Matter of fact, I saw an interesting article in the Wall Street Journal, and it was a Japanese talking about the job report and moving things around, and there's a Japanese piece of equipment that's moving a bunch of pipes around. The fact is that the tariffs have increased the cost of U.S. exports. The dollar has been running up again, at least partially because of tariffs, because people have to have dollars to buy things. And the end result is that our manufactured good trade has been declining, our exports have been declining, and our imports have been increasing. And the irony is, a big chunk of that's because of tariffs. And that's one of those things where this is a grand experiment the president is executing across the board that says, here's what economics, the law, the quote laws, end quote, of economics say we should do under these circumstances. Let's do the opposite, and let's do it with a great deal of enthusiasm and see if it works. And we have a caller on 773-1400. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, guys, I have a question. There's been a lot of talk about sanctions of other countries, and I don't want to litigate the politics, but what, from an economic and financial standpoint, are sanctions against a country? Thanks.
Complex answer to that simple question.
First off, I have to say that sanction is one of my favorite words.
Really?
Yeah, it's a nomonym, which means it's its own opposite. You can sanction something, meaning agree to it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Or
cool.
You can sanction something, mean you disagree to it. It's very much like the word ban, although the older version of ban is only used when they say posting wedding bans.
How about a banshee?
Or the banner. But to ban something means that they're not allowed anymore, but you can also ban something to say it's allowed. another one is fast. So fasten something is to slow it down tremendously. If you fasten your seatbelt, it is locked in place.
But you're not going anywhere.
Right. So fast means to move quickly or to not move at all. So sanction as an item in an economy, it depends on the size of the economy being sanctioned and the type of sanctions. So many of the sanctions on Russia right now are not that horrible as far as the Russian overall economy goes. They are horrible to the people, the specific people that have been named that can't do business outside the country, as opposed to sanctions on North Korea, which basically says nobody can do business outside of North Korea unless you're doing it on the black market. And they do it on the black market, but so as a percentage of the economy, it's going to fluctuate with the given sanction. It's very much like tariffs in that Sanctions tend to be temporary. They are usually not given an end date. They're given a start date. The end date can be on a whim, a telephone call, an email, nowadays on a tweet, to say the end of it. So the effect on the economy isn't the size or the target of the sanctions so much as the uncertainty of the sanctions. If you are a common business owner, not that that's common, but not doing weapon sales, that sort of thing, just you're trying to make a living, you're trying to make a profit, you're selling to other countries, you're buying from other countries. If you're looking at your long-term supply chain and one piece of the chain just got a sanction on it, you're going to want to change your entire supply chain. And once that sanction goes away, unless the incentive to go back to that country on the supply chain is big, there's permanent damage from the sanction. And if you think of North Korea, well, they weren't providing a whole lot that people were wanting to buy anyway, but they were buying from a lot of people. If you think of United Arab Emirates, they were sanctioned by multiple parties over the last several decades, and it's had big effects on them, but it didn't really have a big effect on even the oil market. So thinking along those lines, the sanctions, as long as they're being done by a large group of countries to one country, has no great impact on the large group of countries, has a big impact on the single country. As a percentage of the whole, it's really hard to measure because you're kind of measuring a negative. How much would North Korea have been producing on the global economy if it didn't have sanctions? We don't know. It's kind of like what would have happened if you hadn't taken your high blood pressure medicine. Well, we don't know. We only know where it was at the time you started taking it, and if that was decades ago, we have no clue where you would be today without it. That is where medicine and the economy come together. They're both more art than science at the moment. There's some science involved. I hope that was at least somewhat informative answer.
Well, sanctions, for instance, on Iran, if they were truly in place and they were truly enforced, theoretically would chop enough out of the global oil supply that it would raise the prices of oil. However, the Trump administration, for example, and this is very common, presidents have done this for a long time, exempted a whole bunch of countries.
Yeah, very much like the tariffs that we have. Right. Elsewhere, there's exemption as a case by case.
And because he exempted so many countries, it really didn't have a huge effect. But now that one is a sign that if a country is supplying a critical commodity to the world economy and a commodity that's in balance, applying sanctions to that whole country on that commodity can have an economic effect.
I'll give you a quick example. Rare earth metals, rare earth magnets, the number one supplier to the world, almost the only supplier to the world. We have a very tiny output in this area. The company that runs it is going bankrupt right now in California. There's only one rare earth metals mine in the world that's fully functional right now, and that's in China. If we were to sanction China on all their goods, your electronics would get more expensive, all of them. Everybody's electronics would get more expensive. To track it to the sanction would be very difficult because those rare earth metals are in so many different things. They're in so many different items that pass through many different countries. So if you think about the sensors in your computer or in your phone that tell it what direction you're facing and whether it's upside down or right side up have rare earth metals in them. And those rare earth metals are taken from China. They are refined sometimes in Thailand, sometimes in Turkey, sometimes in the United States. Then they're sent on to Vietnam, where they're put into a sensor, and then the sensor is then shipped on to China, where it's put into a phone. And then so each one of those steps is a higher cost associated with the original supply chain. That's where we get complicated. That's where, you know, a sanction on a given item that is in high demand and not balanced well with the rest of the world, you can have very disproportionate price increases. As an example, we made 73% of our steel in the United States pre-tariff. The 25% tariff on steel caused the price of steel to nearly double and then has now settled back down at a 40% increase on the value. So a 25% tariff increased the price of steel by 40%. There's a way of following the math through there, but it's very much like meteorologists trying to figure out probabilities. There's a lot of data. There's a lot of stuff that's going on, a lot of variables. The variables are now there's less steel in the United States to manufacture things with. So the new steel might only have a 25% extra tariff on it, but it also has a longer delivery period because you got to do the paperwork for the tariff. So it may take an extra month to get the steel into the country, which means you go to an American manufacturer who can now charge more than the 25% increase because they have steel there, except they don't have enough steel to go around, which is why it's 40% increase. Sanctions and tariffs are very hard to measure, particularly when they're broad and not uniform.
And they need another thing about sanctions and tariffs that we need to emphasize here. They have been effective at various times in history, but they are very effective when they're very narrow and highly enforced.
Highly enforced, highly uniform. And no exceptions granted. You right. are just going to pay this extra amount, period.
And very narrow. In other words, if we sanction, let's just say that there's a person in Russia who does bad things. There are several, I think.
There's more than several, I think.
And we say, okay, not only are we going to sanction this person, but we're going to get the CIA involved and figure out all the businesses he has any interest in at all. And we're going to sanction all of those simultaneously. Now we begin to see some effect because this person who is doing bad things is getting financially punished.
There's another way of looking at this. This is popularity-based, but it's still monetary. The Me Too movement is a form of sanctioning. It's not done by a government. It's done by a group of people that agree with it. Any kind of boycott is along those lines. If you have a focused enough boycott with enough discipline to stay focused, you can have a very real impact on an entire industry. So Hollywood has been hit hard by the Me Too movement, where IBM, Facebook, Intel, or any of the other major corporations really haven't been hit that hard by it.
But some of those are getting hit by the privacy movement.
Yes.
So even though, well, for instance, several of Facebook is basically come out with privacy codes now that are in excess of U.S. law.
Right.
And so sanctions have an effect, but they just have to be applied carefully. They have to be applied narrowly.
And you have to have a memory. You have to remember to maintain them.
And this is the key. When sanctions are ineffective, and I'll just, this isn't political, it's economics, is when they're broad-based and vague. In other words, the sanctions, the tariffs,
and not enforced well.
Right, and the tariffs we have against China are not going to be very effective in their end result.
And we're about out of time this hour. You can also compare that to grounding a teenager. It's got to be enforced. We're about out of time. If you'd like to contact us off the air, locally, voicemail 254-947-1111. Email Jeff at tpwc.com or Jake at tpwc.com. Go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back next hour with more of The Personal Wealth Coach.